Good morning, Mr. Haley.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Jim Haley for Appellant Kevin Raisin. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve approximately 5 minutes for rebuttal, and I thought I would focus on two arguments that I did rebut on in my written papers. That is the gang participation argument, the constitutionality of that statute, and also our argument about the DNA admissibility. If I could, Your Honors.
Very well.
On the gang participation, Your Honor. It's our submission that that statute, by its very wording, begs a question. Namely, the statute forbids active participation in a criminal street gang, which begs the question, what is active participation in a criminal street gang? And then the statute goes on to provide no definition of what that term is. I understand from the state's reply that United States versus Scales are offered that the words active membership, active participation is adequate notice to a defendant to pass constitutional muster. But I would submit that since that Scales case in 1960, in the middle of a Red Scare to some degree, constitutional jurisprudence has progressed. And if you look, the court looks to the Collender case, which was a 1983 decision. The court in that case said that the statute, criminal statute, must give actual notice of the forbidden conduct, and also it must give law enforcement a guide to who falls within the net to be what fish are within that net of criminal activity and who's not in the net. And it should not be so wide a net that the law enforcement can cast that out and then sort out who they want to charge and who they don't want to charge based on the broad language of a criminal statute. So it's our submission that the Scales definition of active participation, that is more than passive, more than nominal, which I argued was simply a tautology in my reply brief, that is no longer adequate because jurisprudence has moved on since Scales. And as the court now requires, to avoid a vagueness challenge, it must give actual notice and also establish minimal guidelines to govern law enforcement. And in this case, this statute does not do that. And for that reason...
Is it your position that... I understand you to be saying that a definition that says more than nominal or passive really doesn't advance the ball much and shouldn't be relied upon.
Yes, sir.
But is it your position that there's no way to define active participation? Those are two pretty basic words. It's not anything exotic here.
Yes, Your Honor. I think it could be defined and should have been defined to be constitutional. It could have been defined as an act which is otherwise criminal under this code. Then the person would know, well, if I'm doing something criminal under this code, that would be a step of active participation. In the Scales case, the court said in that case, it recognized the problem, the Scales court. Your Honor, at page 323 of that decision, the court dealt with the issue of the point at which one shades into the other, that is from non-active to active, is something that goes not to the sufficiency of the statute, but to the adequacy of the trial court's guidance to the jury by way of instructions in a particular case, which is totally at odds with how we interpret criminal statutes now. They must not be solved or explained to a jury at the end of the case. They've got to be adequate at the very outset to give a citizen an idea of what he or she is not supposed to do.
Let me see if I understand your position.
Yes, sir.
The way the statute appears to read, if a defendant knowingly engages in conduct that in itself may not be criminal for the purpose of aiding or furthering the gang's commission of conduct that is criminal,
yes, sir,
and that conduct is enumerated in the statute, then there can be a conviction under the statute, correct?
There's a logic to that, yes, Your Honor.
All right. And your position, as I understand your answer to Justice Berger's question, is that the only way for the statute of that structured that way to be constitutional is for the conduct itself of the purported gang member to be criminal.
I was answering Her Honor's question about...
Is that right?
That was my example of how it could be constitutional.
Is there some other way for it to be constitutional other than to criminalize the intermediate conduct?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
So that's your position?
That to me is the brightest line that the legislature could give the public about what is active participation by defining it as some kind of criminal act, which in itself.
Okay, so under that interpretation, the defendant could be indicted and prosecuted for the supplementary conduct because it's a crime in its own right.
Yes, Your Honor.
For the gang-related crime.
Yes, Your Honor. Right. Yes, Your Honor. And I understand that the state looks to a California case, California is doing this active participation now. It's in the late 90s and 2000. They're having no problem prosecuting under this statute. But I would submit that that does not really deal with the issue that we have with the statute. And a California experience with gangs may be quite different from our experience with gangs, and there may be a need for that jurisdiction to prosecute gang participation.
Well, is that the focus, or is it the plain meaning of the words?
Well, I submit and picking up on that point, one problem the California courts had was active participation. If the court reads the Castaneda case relied upon by the state, part of the problem was that the California courts looked to Scales in part because the Scales instruction, which the Scales court thought solved the problem, says that in determining whether he was an active or inactive member, consider how much of the time and efforts he's devoted to the party, that is the Communist Party, was the Scales issue. To be active, he must have devoted all or a substantial part or of his time and efforts to the party. And so the California courts, to define active, they got lost in that little thicket there about how much time you spend on your time to be quote-unquote active. And all we have here, of course, is the it's more than nominal.
I guess
more
my
than
point
passive.
Is that, or inquiry is, that it's a focus on the meaning of the language, not whether gangs are different in California than they are in Delaware.
That's right. That's correct. I just was suggesting that perhaps the problems in California are such a degree that they're finding a way to deal with gangs as best they can in that jurisdiction. But you're right, as a policy matter. But as a language matter, it's certainly, as you say, just a language problem. But I think the language problem is the same no matter where it appears, is my argument. Yes, Your Honor. I'll go on to my second argument, Your Honor, is about the DNA, if I could. Your Honor, as Your Honor knows from the facts, I assume there's some familiarity with the facts. There was a weapon recovered in this matter, a weapon that was apparently used at two separate incidents. And the question was whose DNA was on that weapon. And it was the state's argument that my client, Kevin Raisin, was convicted of ultimately of shooting the weapon on May 3, killing Jose Charias. And so scientific corroboration of that claim was key to the state's case. And so they had the weapon tested by way of a DNA sampling. And the DNA sample came back, compared to Kevin Raisin's DNA, that he, quote unquote, could not be excluded from his DNA being on that weapon. And that was as far as the logic went, probability went, from the state's expert witness. And our argument was before trial.
Didn't the expert also testify that several other people could not be excluded?
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, the only one who could be excluded was a gentleman named Jose Ortiz. So he was excluded definitively. But other than that, there were five individuals who could not be excluded.
So your client wasn't the only one left in the mix?
That's correct, Your Honor. But the problem was that nobody else was excluded that we know of. That the set of persons who were not excluded, there was no limit to that subset, that set of people. And it gave no way for a person to compare what's the likelihood of Raisin being on this versus the set of persons we've written off who aren't on this.
Wasn't
weapon.
The evidence of marginal value? And this isn't evidence that you want to keep out that was really crucial. It was of limited value, and the question I have is, what difference did it make?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that the DNA offers a patina of science to the state's case. That it appears to corroborate Well, he can't be excluded. Perhaps it is this guy.
Didn't the expert say there were lots of other people who also were not excluded?
Well, I got her to agree that she could not exclude a substantial portion of the American population, American male population, for example. Yes, Your Honor.
So you're saying, and tell me if I've got it right.
Yes, Your Honor.
That because the DNA expert evidence had a patina of scientific validity, that the jury would somehow be confused into believing that, based on that evidence, that your client either committed the crime or it was more likely than not that he did.
Yes, that there was a scientific endorsement.
Okay.
To the
case. Was there a jury instruction of any kind?
Yes, it was an expert evidence jury instruction. Yes, Your Honor.
And did the instruction tell the jury that, or have the effect of telling the jury, not to draw that type of conclusion?
It was a standard expert instruction, Your Honor, jury instruction, so it certainly directed them to assessing on the basis of possibilities, or probabilities, and not possibilities. It was a standard instruction, Your Honor.
And did the defense counsel at trial argue that this evidence was marginal and didn't show a probability of anything?
We did, by way of pretrial motion and motions during trial also, Your Honor.
Mr. Haley, you're into your reserve time. Would you like to continue?
I'll save that for rebuttal, Your Honor, if you would. Thank you.
Very well. Morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mike Hyden, I represent Mark Taylor. I have raised two issues on appeal for Mr. Taylor. The first relates to the gang participation statute, and the second regards a hearsay objection. In connection with the gang participation statute, I would point out to the court that Mark Taylor was not a member of the Trap Stars. And I don't think that's in dispute. He knew two of them, but he wasn't a member. And when you look at the statute defines a criminal street gang as one who has the primary activity of certain crimes. Now, the Trap Stars...
Wasn't there evidence, I can't remember who the witness was, to the effect that Taylor himself told the gang, well, I'm in. I'm one of you, or something to that effect?
There was, I think, a comment that I like the way you guys roll, or something to that effect.
Wasn't that evidence sufficient for a jury to conclude that he was a member of the gang? He self-identified as a member of the gang.
No, he wasn't identified as a member, and he wasn't part of the group, but that was a comment that...
Well, you say that as a fact, but the question is it a found fact?
That he said that?
No, that he wasn't a member. I mean, you tell us that, but the other side says, yes, there's evidence from which it could be concluded that he was.
I think their argument would be that he wasn't a member, but he did assist them. And the issue is this. The Trap Stars, they had a legitimate stated purpose. They were a musical group, which makes them different from in these other cases that you see in California and around the country that involve the Hells Angels or the Sir 13 or something like that.
Well, again, the evidence which the state argues to us is that they may have had a legitimate end purpose, but the means of getting there was to sell drugs, which was not legitimate.
Well, then the question is, what was their primary activity? And the statute refers to that.
So if they were drug sellers, but their primary activity was to finance producing rap songs, that's not illegal. That's not criminal.
Well, it may be criminal, but their primary activity is to sell records and to make records. Some of them, individually, may have sold drugs, but they didn't do it as a group, and it wasn't an organized effort to sell drugs.
Is that a fact, too, or is that a...
I think the state would agree with that.
Your side of the factual
issue. I think the state would agree that the ones that sold drugs operated independently. There wasn't a sharing of the profits. There wasn't any organizational structure. It was that some of them sold drugs and some of them did not. Mark Taylor.
So they were a group as far as they were all trying to sell rap or to do rap songs, but when it came to selling drugs, they were a bunch of atomized, disorganized individuals?
Sure. I mean, let's look at it as a different type of organization. You might have a legitimate organization where, let's say, the Philadelphia Eagles fan club, where they are organized for a certain purpose, but then you have a group of them, either individually or collectively under the statute, that commit certain crimes.
And that doesn't make that a, were those arguments that you just made to us made to the jury?
Made to the jury? The I don't recall specifically if I made that argument to the jury. But
I thought there was evidence in the record that the Trapsters as a group accumulated their weapons and drugs and kept them in one place, and part of the reason that we led to all of this other criminal activity is a rival group raided this collection. And so you're telling us now that that collection wasn't the Trapsters' collection, it was the collection of a couple of individuals in the group.
Two or three.
Who happened to store them in the same place.
Those two guys lived together. And I think it was the prosecution that referred to it as the trap store house or the trap store location. The trap stores didn't do it. Two of them lived there, and that house was burglarized by part of the other group. But nonetheless, if you look at Mark Taylor's individual acts, he was convicted of possession of drugs, and he was convicted of an assault involving a shooting. None of those involved any trap store activities. He wasn't selling drugs for the trap stores. He wasn't in their neighborhoods. The assault that he was involved in didn't involve somebody from the other group. It just happened one, these things that happened in the middle of the night in a bad section of town.
He was convicted under the gang statute, wasn't he?
He was. But he was not convicted under the conspiracy charge. And there was only one charge in the indictment besides the gang statute that involved him acting in concert with somebody else, and that was the conspiracy charge. And the jury found him not guilty of conspiracy. They found him guilty of possession of drugs, which had nothing to do with the trap stars, and they found him guilty of the assault.
And what's the significance of that fact?
Well, if you are going to decide whether he's working in concert with the trap stars or whether he's trying to advance or further their interests or their goals, then you would think the crimes that he is involved in would have something to do with the trap stars, but they didn't. And
let's focus on your legal argument. Are you saying the jury's verdict was inconsistent? Are you saying there's insufficient evidence to convict him of gang activity? What's the legal argument that we would glean from what you're telling us?
Well, I think I think what happens is that the statute, and we have argued that it's overbroad and unconstitutionally vague. And what happens, it drags him into the crime and the activities of these other guys. But he really didn't and wasn't committing crimes with those.
You're saying he's a standalone drug dealer who happened to know members of the gang, and the statute's so broad that you could convict him of gang activity even though he wasn't in the gang and he was really a standalone criminal.
Exactly.
And for that reason, the statute's unconstitutional on its face as opposed to as applied?
Because he's going to have
Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The other argument that I raised was the hearsay argument was that when one of the shootings occurred, a witness came up and made a statement that another witness said Gunner shot the guy. And Mark Taylor had the nickname Gunner. However, there was another guy in the case who had a nickname Gunner. And he was part of this other group, Pope's group. And when he testified that he was looking for trap stars. He was going to shoot trap stars, and he was looking to kill them. Now, And he was looking in the area where the shooting occurred and at the time that the shooting occurred. Now, my objection at that time was that it was hearsay, and the state said, well, it's an excited utterance or spontaneous statement. I'm not sure that the foundation was developed to make that argument. We don't know anything about that witness's observation. We don't know whether that was based upon hearsay. We don't know where and how and why he said that. There was no showing by the state that he was unavailable, and therefore the defense, we didn't have a chance to cross-examine him. It could have been that the gunner that he saw was this Tyre Brooks, who was the guy who was looking to shoot people that night.
That's a separate argument, though, isn't it? I mean, the hearsay argument is this testimony shouldn't have come in at all.
Right.
And the second argument appears to be, even if it did come in, it was not properly directed because it could have referred to somebody other than the defendant.
Correct.
How are we supposed to handle the second argument? Was that an argument made to the jury?
Well, it was made to the jury. Thank you.
I have a question on that. If the statement had been made to a 911 operator, would it have been admissible?
Probably so, but there's a... the authenticity of the statement, at least, you know, the fact that it was made, it would be played to the jury. Now, and I guess there's different rules for a 911 call, but at least you would have that authenticity of being able at least to hear the statement. This is someone is saying that the statement was made.
But the actual ruling, as I understand it, was that it was a present sense impression.
Right.
Okay, so not an excited utterance or something else.
Right.
But a present sense impression.
Okay. Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Maria Knoll representing the State of Delaware. Your Honors, the gang participation statute, as set forth in Title 11, Section 616, is constitutional. The terms of the statute are sufficiently explicit to inform those subject to it of the prohibited conduct, and persons of common intelligence can understand it and not argue as to its meaning. The language
of the statute... Okay, so what does active participation mean?
Well, as decided both by Scales and also by the California courts, which have the substantially the same statute, means more than nominal. And while that might sound as if that is not much of a definition, the reality is the word active is an easily understood word. It's also, if you read it in context with the rest of the statute, under the forbidden conduct, it says a person who actively participates and adds the element of knowingly promoting, furthering, or assisting in criminal conduct. So that is part of your active participation. So you would know that to actively participate would be not only to have knowledge of the criminal street gang, be with the street gang, know of their commission of criminal offenses, and also knowingly promoting those criminal offenses.
So you have to commit what would, I guess in another context, would be an overt act of some kind?
Your Honor, you yourself do not have to commit the overt act. You have to knowingly participate with the gang and promote their acts.
But that just raises the same question. If I sit back in an armchair and I'm rooting for the gang, but I don't do anything, is that active participation?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, you have to know that they already commit in criminal acts. And
right, I know all that, but I just sit back in an armchair and silently root for them. Am I guilty under the statute of anything?
Your Honor, I don't think rooting for them or saying you people are great is enough to satisfy knowingly promoting, furthering,
right,
or
and
assisting.
So what else has to be done?
Well, you have to know that you're promoting and assisting them in committing a Delaware felony. It's
okay.
Not just disorderly
that.
Conduct.
Let's say I know that, but what else is required? Because it's so far, the defendant is sitting back in the armchair. You know, he's operating mentally, but he's not engaged in any physical activity. The question is, what physical activity is required under the statute?
Your Honor, it seems to me that under the statute, you would at least have to be an accomplice of some sort in the criminal activity.
Okay, so if you're an accomplice within the meaning of the criminal code, mm-hmm. that helps.
That does help, of course.
That works.
Yes.
Anything short of that?
I believe that's probably correct, Your Honor, yes.
What's probably correct?
Well, I mean, the statute contemplates being an accomplice or conspiring with the other members.
Okay, so if you were planning, if you helped them plan the crime,
you
and then sat back in the armchair while the others committed the crime, that would suffice?
Yes, Your Honor, that would suffice.
All right.
Well, in this case, after there was the burglary, if you heard about that, and you were standing with gang members, mm-hmm. and you said, you all should go do something about that. Is that criminal activity?
I don't believe that qualifies under the statute as criminal activity, just to say something should be done about that.
So we know about Raisin. He's got a lot of involvement that you can talk about, I'm sure.
Sure.
But tell us about Taylor. What did Taylor do that justified conviction under the, gang statute?
My understanding with respect to Taylor, Your Honor, is that the meeting that happened after Mills' house was shot up, they were all at, I believe it was Ortiz's house, discussing what the next steps were going to be. They all at that time agreed that they were going to shoot members of Hope's group on site. He was there as well. He, at that point, said, I like the way you roll, I'm with you all, and was seen at most of these crime sites. He also, when he was found with the weapon in Julie DeLeon's house, that was the weapon. He was holding that weapon for the gang members, because that is the weapon that was used in the shooting of Pope and the weapon that was used in the attempted murder of Jasmine Smith and Kenneth Swanson. So that was the weapon he had, and he was trying to hide when he was arrested. So that shows gang participation. He has the weapon that's being used by everybody in these crimes. Then when we go forward to where he shot Larry Y, he was with Valentine at the time he shot Larry Y. Valentine, I believe, pled to a conspiracy charge with regard to that, and he was associated with the Trap Stars. And his reasoning for shooting Larry Y was that he thought that Larry Y was members of the group that were trying to seek retribution from the Trap Stars, so he was paranoid and shot Larry Y. That's a group activity.
So going back to the point that your opponents were making, mm-hmm. Trap Stars probably don't give out membership cards, but I assume what you're saying is membership is irrelevant in the gang, whatever constitutes membership. To be convicted under the statute, you need active participation with the gang activity, and what you just outlined as it relates to Taylor satisfies the statute.
Yes, Your Honor. That's exactly the state's argument.
So Your that would encompass a recruit who's doing everything that a gang member does and just hasn't been initiated yet, as long as he's actively participating.
Correct, Your Honor. That's what the statute indicates. As long as we can establish that the gang exists and that this person is actively participating with the gang and promoting felonious conduct by the gang. With respect to this particular statute, Your Honor, I believe as the state has briefed, California has upheld this statute many times. Scales versus United States has defined active participation. I don't believe anything has changed with respect to that reasoning. Other states have a similar statute, including California, Indiana, Iowa, D.C., Maryland, Missouri, Virginia. And as far as the state could tell, it has not been found unconstitutional. The state submits that it is not vague. It is not overbroad because it is not prohibiting activity that is otherwise something that the First Amendment protects. The First Amendment does not protect activity of promoting felonious conduct. So the state would submit that the statute itself is constitutional. With respect, if I could go on to another topic, Your Honor.
Sure.
With respect to the DNA argument by Mr. Haley, the state would submit that that evidence was relevant to the prosecution. Mr. Haley does not contend that either the expert was inaccurate or the results were inaccurate, just that the evidence itself didn't basically move the ball forward for the state. And the state would say that it did. The state was trying to prove gang participation and was trying to prove the independent crimes. The fact that the gun could, that Raisin and Taylor and Valentine could not be excluded from the gun was, of course, relevant, Faison as well, because Faison himself testified that these are who would have been touching this gun. This is our community gun.
Well, so the DNA evidence was relevant legally.
Yes.
But would you agree that it was the degree of relevance was marginal? There were, after all, four sets of prints on the gun.
Correct, Your Honor. It was a mixed sample with at least four sets of prints. I believe there was actually two unknown people on it as well. But while even though it may not have been extremely relevant, there was some relevance to it. The fact that Ortiz was excluded is also relevant for the state because part of the defense's case was that Ortiz was the mastermind of all of this. So his exclusion is relevant as well. And it also went to corroborate Faison's testimony that a number of people were touching that gun. So as far as the state sees this evidence, Your Honor, it was relevant and there was not an abuse of discretion to admit it in the trial.
Was an argument made that its probative value was far outweighed by its prejudicial effect in the sense that the minute the jury hears DNA, they figure that's it. The state won, whereas in this case the DNA evidence was really of very, very little significance.
Your Honor, that argument was made, that the probative value was outweighed by the prejudicial effect. However, looking at the context of this case, in cross-examination it was established that a number of people could not be excluded from this gun.
As in almost all the male population.
Correct. Anybody in the male line, since it was YSTR testing.
Right, which is why one has to wonder what the value of that evidence was other than the value of sounding like we've got solid scientific evidence here to bolster our case.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor. I believe, you know, when you look at the record, it was pretty clear what, if any, value the DNA had. It was not a huge part of the case, but it was established that although Raisin couldn't be excluded, even Mr. Haley said, is it possible I could be included? And the answer was yes. So it was relevant to the state's case to show factors the state needed to show.
Well, we understand that. Mm-hmm. The question is, was the legal relevance or logical relevance outweighed by the prejudice? Which is a Rule 403 objection. Two questions. One, I guess to repeat Justice Berger's, was that objection made under 403? And number two, if it was, did the court engage in a Getz analysis?
I believe it was, yes, Your Honor. And I'm pretty sure. I remember that this was argued a number of times and was up for re-argument.
This is an issue we're being asked to reverse on, so I would hope that you'd have more than a belief.
My understanding, Your Honor, is that it was, well, I know that Mr. Haley argued that the probative value of it did not outweigh the prejudice. Mm-hmm. I know that Judge Cooch denied lower court on both occasions, went through an analysis, and while he said that it was minimally relevant, he said that the probative value outweighed the prejudicial effect.
Well, help us understand what kind of precedent we're setting. In a case, you could have DNA evidence that says the defendant is definitely in by some incredible multiple that there's no doubt it's the defendant's DNA. At the other end of the spectrum, you have the experts say the defendant's excluded. What's the principle that admits evidence that's inconclusive, which is basically what we have here? How do you get that in?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the question is, if it's accurate under 401, whether it is relevant for the state.
Well, tell us the relevance as it relates to the defendant. One explanation you gave us was that someone was excluded that had been raised by the defense as a possibility. Mm-hmm. So that could come in rebuttal, but it wouldn't come in the state's case in chief. And my question is, what's the relevance in in carrying the state's burden of proof that permits this evidence to come in?
The fact that Raisin could not be excluded, Your Honor, this was the gun that was used in the shooting of Pope, so the fact that he couldn't be excluded is relevant. It also goes to corroborate Faison's testimony that the gun was touched by Raisin, Taylor, Valentine, Faison, all of them. So it goes to prove the gang participation charge
Wait a second. I'm confused here. Wasn't the DNA result that all of those other people were also not excluded?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's...
Okay. But if we start with that and we've only got a half a dozen people who are not excluded, that's one thing. But, in fact, we've got the entire male population as not excluded. So how does, you know, you're saying the relevance is it tends to corroborate that these people were touching the gun or were involved in all that. It corroborates nothing if everybody in the United States or all the males would be in the same group.
Well, Your Honor, I do believe that most of the testimony was not that it was every male in the United States, but you would have had to have at least 12 of the alleles that was the same from the alleles that were in the test sample. Raisin had 12 alleles, so did Faison, and so did Taylor. I believe Valentine had 11 of the alleles. When Mr. Haley asked, would I be excluded or would I be included, she said, if you had at least 12 of the alleles, then you would not be excluded. So it's not the entire male population.
Well, just help us understand the state's argument for purposes of establishing a precedent here. In a future case, the state says to the judge, look, we have a DNA test. It doesn't say the defendant's excluded, and it doesn't say it's the defendant's DNA. But it doesn't exclude the defendant. So we want to tell the jury, even though they didn't exclude the defendant and they didn't implicate the defendant, he wasn't excluded. And here's why we want to tell that to the jury. So go ahead.
Well, I would say, Your Honor, that the reason that was used here to tell the jury that he wasn't excluded is because that gun was used in the shootings, and him not being excluded is relevant to show that he may have been, his DNA may actually be on that gun.
Right.
And he was not positively excluded. He could have been excluded. He was not. Ortiz was.
And I understand that perfectly. Now, the defense responds, well, that's true, but most of the male population of the United States is similarly situated. Therefore, the prejudice of suggesting something that connects my client to the gun is outweighed by the fact that most of the male population of the United States is similarly situated. Tell us why that argument doesn't prevail.
Well, in this case?
Generally, you know, what we need to know in every case is, do we understand your case? What are the implications of ruling in your favor?
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be writing something that talks about the admissibility of this type of evidence in the future.
Right. Well, the first thing I would say, Your Honor, is with respect to this type of testing, the YSTR testing, it is not like the general RFLP testing. They only deal with exclusions and exclusions, actually. There's no actual match like you would have in RFLP testing.
Well, we understand that the technology has improved, but that still doesn't answer the question of how does this evidence advance the ball in terms of proving the state's affirmative case?
Well,
it seems that it advances it maybe a micron in terms of distance, but it advances it a heck of a lot more in terms of creating this aura of scientific certainty, and that's the concern that we have.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor. I can say in this case, I'll start out with this case. In this case, there was a vigorous cross-examination that showed the relevance of the DNA. There was also an instruction. With respect to Raisin, this evidence corroborated the other evidence of the fact that he did the shooting that a number of people said that he had done. Erica Jenkins was a witness to him shooting Pope. She went inside and told her friend that...
Well, I think you're arguing that it's not a close case, so it doesn't matter.
In this particular case, yeah, this
right,
is not
but
a close case.
Let's focus on the issues.
Okay. Yeah. Your Honor, the state still is of the opinion that anything that goes to prove its case, given the state's standard beyond a reasonable doubt, is relevant, and the state should be allowed to present it and be subject to cross-examination to show
its actual. Well, that comes back to my question, though. Assuming your relevance argument is 100% correct,
okay,
the whole 403 is addressed to the fact that otherwise relevant evidence is excluded if its prejudicial value is greater than its probative value. So we understand the relevance argument. Help us understand the state's 403 argument.
Well, Your Honor, as I was saying, with respect to this, I don't think that the prejudicial effect outweighed the probative value, because what was presented was exactly what was shown on the DNA. I don't think that there was an aura that DNA shows that Raisin was the one who touched the gun. Everything was presented. Everything was subject to cross-examination, and the jury was instructed how to consider it.
Well, wait a second. It seems like you're trying to have it both ways. You're now saying, well, everybody knew that this DNA evidence was pretty worthless or pretty close to worthless, so therefore there wasn't a whole lot of prejudice here. And I don't think that really addresses the problem, because if you can make a credible argument as to why it's relevant at all, which is a tough one, but, you know, assuming you can do that, then you really do have to address why that is should be allowed in, when I think it's kind of, we could almost take judicial notice of the fact that DNA evidence carries with it, in most people's mind, an aura of importance and infallibility and so forth. I understand that there's cross-examination, and I understand that the other side tries to show how, well, this evidence really doesn't prove much of anything, but that doesn't address the overall impact of introducing DNA evidence that is not really very probative, but still is DNA evidence.
Your Honor, the state would just argue that the evidence itself is admissible. What it showed goes to the weight that the jury gives it.
But we're talking about the relative probative value versus its prejudicial effect. Explain why this is not more prejudicial than it is probative.
Well, as I had stated, especially in this case, the probative value showed a number of factors that the state needed to prove for its case. That there was the shared gun, which just by the fact that it was a mixed sample with anywhere between 3 and 6 people is corroborated by the fact of this DNA, corroborates Faison's testimony, and it shows that Ortiz was excluded and he was not involved, which was a theme throughout the case. The judge did an analysis and found that the probative value, and he did, I believe, say it was minimal. He still indicated that it outweighed the prejudice in this particular case. I can't say that it would be in every case, but in this case, the value, in addition to all of the other evidence against Raisin, I believe that it was not an abuse of discretion to admit it.
What's going on with the so-called CSI effect? Is there a tactical consideration here that the jury would ask, where's the DNA evidence?
Well, Your Honor, I did think about that, and generally in most cases, as I believe the court is aware, the state is expected to at least have said, we've tested for this. And in this case, we did test for it. So to have not tested for it leaves an idea out there that the state either didn't want to test it or tested it and they just have no idea what happened. In this case, the state did what it should have done, and it tested this gun and provided the results to the jury. And given the tenor of the way cases go with the fact that DNA exists, it was part of the state's case to show that the state did its job and that it and what the results were, whether they be good or not. The fact, had we not done any testing, we wouldn't have presented any testing, and the question wouldn't have been out there. The state could have tested the gun, didn't test the gun. You can think whatever you want. Well, now we have the results, and we provided them.
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Can I say a brief rebuttal, Your Honors? On the second argument about the DNA, Your Honors, if you would, I'm not sure if Your Honors caught it, but at one point in her remarks, Ms. Knoll said that the evidence proved that it was touched by raisin, so-and-so. It shows how easy it is for DNA evidence with the frame being could not be excluded. The mind kind of floats into the, it proves something.
What was the state's argument to the jury about the DNA evidence?
As I recall, Your Honor, the state did not go back to that and emphasize it a whole lot in closing argument, frankly, which is probably wise, because I think it would have increased the prejudice of this. But nevertheless, it's an admission, I would submit, Your Honors. If it's not proven something, if it's not relevant, we wouldn't be getting this evidence, I assume a juror could logically think. And it must be proving something. We're getting this scientific thing here, and Kevin Raisin can't be excluded. Ha-ha. You know, the mind kind of, I say, slides down that slope as part of what Ms. Knoll said during some of her remarks, that something's actually being proven here.
Just want to make sure I understand your answer.
Sure.
You're saying that when the time came for summations before the jury, the state didn't focus on that evidence?
I do not recall that, Your Honor. No, I don't have the transcript here, Your Honor, but I do not recall there being a whole lot of emphasis on that in closing argument. Yes, Your Honor. I think I have probably addressed it at some level because it was in play there, but I do not recall the state leaning on it very heavily in closing argument.
Well, without characterizing the rest of the state's case,
yes.
Why wouldn't this be a harmless error if it was an error?
Your Honor, I would submit that, that although we can't know what went on in the jurors' minds, that the risk that this DNA evidence is proving something to me when I heard it. I heard that Kevin Raisin cannot be excluded. And the layperson's not oriented to testing probabilities and populations and demography as a more practiced person might be in one of our positions who's testing evidence like this all the time. But there is a risk of unfair prejudice that operated in some jurors' minds, the effect that the ball was advanced here. The ball was advanced here beyond more than Ortiz is out, so that makes it that population less Ortiz more likely fractionally that Raisin touched this gun. And that risk that happened, Your Honor, is, I would submit, should cause this court to say that this evidence, without some sense of who's being excluded, which the Mississippi court said in Craig versus State, they had the same kind of logic, could not be excluded, but was not admissible unless the expert also said in that case that if someone was picked randomly and tested against this sample, 99.99% of the population would be excluded. And so that narrows the field immensely down. But there's no such exclusion evidence here about any kind of population being excluded. And without that, it leads to speculation that it actually proves something, Your Honors.
Thank you.
So anything else? Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you all for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement and will also take a brief recess.